Roberts, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhibe in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I know that the Western media presents the situation in a totally distorted manner, if only to mention the food crisis, so-called food crisis, as if nothing was of concern before February this year.
That was Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov as he wrapped up a four-country African trip with a stop in Ethiopia. Details coming up. Also, French President Emmanuel Macron is in Benin today, the second stop on a three-country trip to Africa to strengthen political and security ties. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov lashed out at Western countries today as he wrapped up a four-nation trip to Africa with a stop in Ethiopia's capital. Moscow is seeking to bolster support from African countries who have largely declined to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Lavrov's visit comes as the U.S. announced nearly $500 million in additional aid for drought relief in Ethiopia. Fred Harter reports from the capital, Addis Ababa.
At a Wednesday news briefing in Addis Ababa, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov denied Western assertions that his country's invasion of Ukraine is responsible for the global surge in food prices. Lavrov said prices were rising before Russia invaded Ukraine in February due to the COVID-19 pandemic and what he called green policies pursued by the West. He also claims that any additional increases in grain prices were the result of American and European sanctions on Russia.
I know that the Western media presents the situation in a totally distorted manner, if only to mention the food crisis, so-called food crisis, as if nothing was of concern before February this year.
Lavrov is on the last leg of an Africa tour that has included Egypt, Uganda, and the Republic of the Congo. He has sought to reassure regional leaders that grain exports through Ukraine's Black Sea ports will resume, while pinning the blame for their halt on the West. Lavrov alleged Wednesday that the sanctions imposed on Russia are a sign that the United States wants a return to what he called a colonial world order.
The West created a system which was based on certain principles: free market, fair competition, sanctity of the private property, presumption of innocence, something else. All these principles have been thrown down the drain when they needed to do what they believe is to punish Russia.
While in Addis, Lavrov met with the Ethiopian Foreign Minister, Demeke Mekonnen. The pair agreed to strengthen cooperation and economic ties, according to state media. There is no indication that Lavrov met with Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who has not been seen in public lately, or with officials from the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa. AU officials told VOA that Lavrov's stop was a bilateral visit between Russia and Ethiopia. Earlier Wednesday, the US government announced a package of $488 million to help Ethiopia with drought relief efforts. Dry weather and conflict have left 30 million Ethiopians in need of aid. Announcing the new funds, Tracy Ann Jacobson, the US charge d'affaires in Ethiopia, said weather conditions across the region were the worst in recorded history. The new U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn, Mike Hammer, is expected to arrive in Ethiopia on Wednesday, his first visit to the country, where the U.S. is supporting efforts to mediate between the federal government and rebels from the Tigray region in the north. Fred Harter for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov concluded his Africa Charm offensive that took him to Egypt, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Uganda, and Ethiopia, countries which have recently seen strained relations with the West. His trip seems to be designed to shore up support for Russia on the international stage. VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Chenawi discussed Lavrov's tour objectives and what was achieved with Mark Katz, a professor of government and politics at George Mason University and an authority in Russian policies.
Well, I think what the Russians are very concerned about is undermining the Western narrative that Russia's actions have hurt grain exports from Ukraine and from the Black Sea in general that Africa is so dependent upon. So what they're trying to do, of course, is to blame the grain shortages on the West. This is very important that Russia do this. Of course, it's actually its own actions that have led to this terrible situation. I think also what Lavrov has in mind is UN General Assembly votes. In other words, there are some 50-odd countries in Africa. They're a huge group of countries that, even if they don't vote in favor of Russia, they can at least not vote in favor of the West. So many of them abstained on the UN General Assembly resolution condemning Russia for their invasion, and Lavrov wants to keep it this way.
Ahead of his visit, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that Russia had long-standing good relations with Africa since the days of the Soviet Union, and he lauded Russia's role in decolonization in Africa, saying, "We provided assistance to the national liberation movements and then to the restoration of independent states and the rise of their economies." Would that narrative help Lavrov achieve his African tour objectives?
It might, but the thing is that it really is sort of ahistorical. In fact, the Soviets didn't do all that much to help the African liberation movements. But most of the assistance they gave was to African governments after they became independent. I think also one has to point out that, many of the governments whom they did support were terrible dictatorships, but nevertheless, they're claiming this credit. I think what Africans have to ask is, what's Russia doing for us now? And I don't think that, in other words, Africa was becoming independent anyway. The United States did a lot to encourage this. The British were willing to leave, maybe the French less so, but they did leave. So I think that the Soviet contribution to this whole African independence was much more modest than Lavrov is now claiming.
Most Arab and African countries, as you said, have refused to take sides in the Russian invasion of Ukraine, as they share interests with both stakeholders. The fragile economies of the countries in Africa and the Middle East have also suffered the most from the war due to the skyrocketing oil prices and the food crisis. Lavrov stressed that Russia is committed to fulfilling its grain export obligations as per the recent UN brokered deal it signed with Kiev on Friday. How could that provide Russia with more influence in Africa?
I think that what they're really aiming at is to prevent a negative image from grain not flowing. Now, the whole point of grain corridors for Ukrainian grain, this is for grain that's already been harvested and stored in Ukraine. The real problem is that there might not be much of a future harvest in Ukraine because of the war. And so even if the grain that is there gets out, we're going to be running into this problem. Now, whether the Russians themselves can make this up from their own production is unclear. It seems that the Russians they need the grain themselves as well. So I think that even if this Ukrainian grain gets flowing, this is only going to be a temporary solution so long as the war continues.
Ahead of his tour, Lavrov wrote an opinion article stressing Russia's keenness on African states' interests and denied that Russia was to blame for the worldwide food crisis. It was published in top newspapers in Egypt, Ethiopia, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, as well as on the Russian Foreign Ministry's website. How would such a media campaign help spread Russian disinformation during his African tour?
Obviously he has to try, but the point is, if there had been no Russian invasion of Ukraine, there would be no grain crisis. And I think that Western governments need to emphasize that. And I think African governments and populations are smart enough to understand that personally. So obviously they're very desperate on this. They understand that this is a weak point, that their invasion of Ukraine has caused problems for a lot of countries, and they want to shift the blame. Whether they can do so or not remains to be seen.
That was Mark Katz, professor of government and politics at George Mason University and an authority in Russian politics, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. The U.S. has announced $488 million in humanitarian assistance for Ethiopia to help the nation respond to a prolonged drought that's threatening to survival of 8.1 million people.
The funding will target about 7.4 million people in need of immediate food assistance by providing sorghum, yellow split peas, and vegetable oil, according to a statement by the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. Part of the money will also go to helping more than 4.7 million children under 5 years of age at risk of malnutrition this year. The announcement comes as Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visits the Horn of Africa nation today as part of a four-country tour of Africa. The U.S. stopped providing security and economic assistance to Ethiopia in May last year because of a conflict in its northern Tigray region, but continued to offer humanitarian aid. Ethiopia's food production was hit by the civil war as well as the worst drought in four decades. The situation was exacerbated by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which contributed to making key imports like wheat and fuel more costly. In some drought-affected parts of the country, armed conflict is limiting access to food and income, according to USAID's statement. Communities across southern and southeastern Ethiopia are experiencing widespread crop losses, and 2.5 million livestock deaths have been reported, a significant loss in sources of food and income. Former Burkina Faso President Blaise Compaoré has apologized to the family of his late predecessor, Thomas Sankara, who was gunned down by a hit squad during the 1987 coup that brought Compaoré to power. Compaoré was sentenced in absentia to life in jail in April for the killing of the revolutionary icon. He returned from exile for a few days earlier this month to take part in a summit of former presidents hosted by the ruling military junta. Many Burkinabes were furious to see him return as a free man. In a message read by government spokesman Lionel Bilgo, Compaoré asked the Burkinabe people for forgiveness for all the acts I may have committed during my tenure, and especially the family of my brother and friend, Thomas Sankara. But he did not directly take responsibility for Sankara's death. Lesotho has dropped charges against former Prime Minister Thomas Tabene, who was accused of hiring a hitman to kill his ex-wife during a messy divorce in 2017. Prosecutor Gareth Lapan told the Maseru court that he hadn't been able to find a decisive witness. Tabane's current wife, Maisia Tabane, whom he wed less than 2 months after the crime, was also cleared. The killing set off a political crisis in the Mountain Kingdom and pushed Tabane out of office in May 2020. Four other co-defendants were on trial. All suspected hitmen allegedly paid several thousand euros to shoot Lipole Tabane. Supporters of the veteran leader say the murder allegations are based on the political motivations of his opponents. Somali officials say two explosions today in the lower Shabelle region have killed at least 18 people, including the mayor of the region's capital. Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the deadliest attack. Mohamed Dasane reports from Mogadishu.
The first attack was a suicide bombing that targeted officials in the town of Marka, the capital of Somalia's lower Shabelle region. The blast killed the mayor of the town, Abdullahi Ali Wafu, and 10 other people, while wounding a number of mayor's bodyguards. A security official in the region told VOA by phone that the bombing took place near the Marka administration headquarters that was aimed at the mayor. The official, who spoke on condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to speak to media, said the fatalities could still rise given the size of the explosion. The Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the deadly attack. Marka is a port city located 92 kilometers from the Somali capital Mogadishu. In a separate incident Wednesday, a bomb exploded at a busy livestock market in the town of Afgoye. Police say the attack was a landmine explosion. Eyewitnesses and medical sources in Avgoye told the VOA the blast killed 7 people and wounded 14 others. Al-Shabaab media said the explosion killed 2 soldiers but didn't claim responsibility. The group said it attacked a convoy carrying Kenyan troops in Bambin near the town of Mandera in northwestern Kenya. The Islamist militant group seems to have increased the size and the scope of its attacks in recent days. A force of several hundred Al-Shabaab fighters crossed into eastern Ethiopia last week, sparking confrontations with Ethiopian security forces. Mohamed Daisane, VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
South African power generation experts say President Cyril Ramaphosa's new action plan to end the country's energy crisis looks impressive, but they are concerned many of the measures won't be implemented by a government that still leans towards burning coal to produce electricity. Ramaphosa has pledged to open up the energy sector to independent power producers to bolster South Africa's ailing electricity grid, which is constrained by power stations that do not work properly. Africa's most industrialized economy has, for almost 15 years, suffered widespread and regular blackouts worsened by corruption and mismanagement at state power utility Eskom. Darren Taylor reports.
When the electricity outages began in 2008, David Lipschitz was one of many energy experts who went to the government with an emergency plan to keep the lights on. The measures suggested by the experts included an immediate deregulation of the energy industry to allow small private electricity firms such as Lipschitz's solar company to feed power into the collapsing national grid. The ruling African National Congress, the ANC, ignored the advice. Instead, according to a recent commission of inquiry, the government failed to maintain power stations and appointed cronies to loot Eskom. The ANC acknowledges this happened, but blames former President Jacob Zuma. He denies responsibility. Lipschitz says Ramaphosa's plan looks good on paper, but it's nothing new, and he'll believe it's an action plan when he sees the action.
The 1998 White Paper on Energy, the 2003 White Paper on Renewable Energy that said 30% of the grid should be in private ownership by 2010. 2010 was 12 years ago. 30% of the grid is not in private ownership. If it was, things may be different.
Energy analyst Adil Nchabaleng's glad that the president's promise to speed up green energy projects like wind farms, but he's also skeptical.
You know, lovely speech, incredible promises made. But as you know, that in South Africa, a lot of these things are promised. But when it comes to implementation, there's always a lack of implementation. So it's not the first time.
The powerful labor unions, which traditionally back the ANC during elections, say they'll fight any and all attempts to privatize electricity provision. They say that'll cause job losses at Eskom, which employs about 45,000 people. Nchabaleng says Eskom will continue to form the bedrock of electricity generation in South Africa, as long as Ramaphosa sticks to his promise of funding the company properly and ending the corruption still prevalent there.
The most important thing in South Africa needed is base load electricity, which means power stations based on coal or nuclear to be functional and to be working 365 days a year, as well as 7 days a week.
Lipschitz says even in 2008, private power companies were producing enough electricity to run almost every household in South Africa with its population of 60 million. But the ANC consistently refused to allow them to sell power. It wanted Eskom, one of its major cash cows, to maintain a market monopoly. As soon as this changes, says Lipschitz, the energy crisis will end.
That whole amount of power can easily be removed from the grid because that's not base load. Base load is from smelters, shopping centers, big industry that cannot remove themselves from the grid in a quick way, except to run their generators.
He says small companies like his should provide electricity to private households, while Eskom concentrates on powering the economy. Unions, however, say the independent companies will raise tariffs that'll make electricity unaffordable to most citizens, and South Africa will be experiencing a crisis of a different kind. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
South Africa's women national soccer team, Banyana Banyana, received a thunderous welcome from thousands of fans who welcomed them yesterday at the O.R. Tambo International Airport in Johannesburg. The team returned home with the 2022 Women's Africa Cup of Nations trophy after beating Morocco 2-1 in the final. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
After 5 years of fighting to get the Women's Africa Cup of Nations title, Banyana Banyana finally landed at the O.R. Tambo International Airport with the trophy in hand. The fans and all the big wigs in soccer were there to welcome them, praising coach Desiree Ellis and honoring the team with the national anthem. Team members were on cloud nine when they arrived at O.R. Tambo International Airport. Coach Desiree could not hide her excitement when she spoke to journalists.
It's out of this world. You cannot describe it. It's just amazing. It gives you goosebumps.
One of the team captains, Janine van Wyk, who was holding the trophy as the team approached the cheering crowd, shared the same excitement.
So I'm just glad that it's happened now.
Popular soccer supporter Jimmy Mutokwa spoke to journalists after traveling more than 500 kilometers from Limpopo province to Johannesburg in Gauteng province just to welcome Banyana Banyana and give advice to the South African Football Association, SAFA.
They make South Africa proud. Today we're here. We're going to celebrate. We're very excited for them. SAFA must give Banyana Banyana what they're worth it, not to give Banyana Banyana small money, because now Banyana Banyana, they bring cup home.
Gloria Hlalele is a former Banyana Banyana player and the first woman to play football in South Africa. She told journalists it was time for the team to be rewarded.
They deserve better. They've done well. They've fought. You know, it's not easy to play in Africa. They've fought. They've shown what's the meaning of wearing the national team jersey. They deserve that money. They must get that money.
The South African Football Association has pledged over $500,000 for the team members to share following their win. The association's president, Danny Jordan, addressed the team and supporters at the welcome ceremony outside the airport.
We are here today to celebrate. The team throughout the tournament said, we cannot let the people back home down. And they did not.
Minister of Sport Natim Tetwa also assured fans that the government will fully support the team. The team won more than just the trophy in this tournament. One member, Andile Dlamini, was named the goalkeeper of the tournament. Another team member, Hilda Magaia, was one of the three top goal scorers of the tournament after scoring three goals. The team also got the National Team of the Year and Fair Play Awards. With South Africa currently going through a gloomy period of power cuts, high unemployment, rising prices and poverty, there's no doubt that the Banyana Banyana win has given the nation one reason to smile again. For VOA News, I am Tuso Kumalo in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.